Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Ashes to Ashes. In this five-part series from The Telegraph, we remember five iconic Ashes tests. Two rival players who took centre stage will relive their roles in one of the longest-running duels in sporting history. Ashes to Ashes, Adelaide 2006. With Mike Hussey.
Ricky sat everyone down and said, right, you guys, we can win this test match. And I remember sitting in the back room thinking, is he serious? Does he really think we can win? And he'd remember him saying to us, look, we can win this test match, but everyone in this room needs to believe that we can win this test match.
And Geraint Jones.
After a defeat, you have to bounce back and you have to show that you've got some determination to it, some character. And I felt that we did that really well. Watching that first day, I knew that there was going to be a lot of runs scored and we'd put ourselves in a great position to do that.
They look down and out at the end of day two, England declaring, putting the pressure on, Australia losing an early wicket. It was all going England's way, but Australia have played stunning test match cricket over the last 3 days.
Shil Berry, The Telegraph's cricket correspondent. No matter how fast you run in your dream, the beast behind catches up with you inexorably. If the happiest tests are the ones you win from nowhere, like Headingley 1981, the reverse must be true. The second test at Adelaide in 2006-07. When England looked to have got back into the series after losing at Brisbane, and could well level it until the nightmare unfolded. All was bright and sunny as Paul Collingwood and Kevin Peterson put together their record fourth wicket stand of 310. Shane Warne was reduced to the closest he has come to ineffectuality. Did Andrew Flintoff declare a touch too early? Even when Australia got close on first innings to England, there seemed to be no alarm. Oh well, at least a draw. England will go to Perth only 1-0 down, confidence restored. Then panic on the fifth morning. In 4 hours, England, petrified at the prospect of defeat and surrendering the Ashes, hit three fours in 4 hours. Flintoff wept as Australia knocked off the target of 168. He was surely not alone. The beast caught us all up and devoured our hopes.
Ashes to Ashes. Paul Hayward, Telegraph chief sports writer.
In 2005, England had reclaimed the Ashes after a 16-year hiatus. The team, now all household names, celebrated at the Oval in a shower of confetti and champagne. International cricket was on a high. The following year, it was time to do it away from home. Here's Geraint Jones.
We were still on a bit of a crest from 2005, although there'd been a bit of turmoil happening with, we'd lost a few players, obviously Vaughan was injured. Trez had his issues, and we'd lost Simon Jones, who was a key bowler in 2005. So it was a bit of a transition period where that side that had been created and put together for 2005 had been torn apart a bit. And so leading into that Ashes series in 2006-07, we were a bit unsure, having had such success in the previous few years. The home series in in 2006 had gone okay. Pakistan, you know, I knew that I was battling for my position to get on the Ashes tour, something I desperately wanted to do, but Chris Reid had taken over, so I was probably more internally focused. But as a side, I knew that we weren't the force that we were, and I think probably the public knew that as well. Although they were still euphoric after 2005, everyone was really looking forward to us getting out to Australia and another incredible series. So there was a lot of anticipation and hope, I suppose.
Both sides went into the series with concerns over fitness and form. Australia's damning assessment of their defeat in 2005 had turned into a desire for revenge. Here's Mike Hussey.
Well, the hype around 2006 was absolutely huge in Australia because we'd just lost the Ashes in 2005. So the build-up and the expectation from the whole public and the media was just electric, really. It was the first Ashes series that I was going to be involved in. And the early team meetings and training sessions, a lot of the guys were still really hurting from the 2005 loss. So I've never seen a team that was so intense and so determined to play well in that series, that's for sure. Well, we actually went out into the bush. We had a boot camp out in the bush, which was... It was tough, but it was a lot of fun as well, and it really just brought the guys closer together. We were taken out of our comfort zone in a lot of ways, and it was interesting to see how different players reacted under different pressures, and we had to work together as a team, and it just finished with Ricky Ponting giving a really inspirational speech to all the guys about the upcoming Ashes series, and now it was time to sort of get into the cricket side of things. We felt really close as a unit, and now the hard work began with the training and obviously into the test matches. So yeah, once we got into Brisbane for the lead up to the first test, we had a few meetings, and as I said, the intensity around the players, we just did not want to leave anything to chance.
They changed the way they were towards us as a team. 2005, they were friendly. We arrived out to Australia in 2006. They hardly said a word to us. It was a real effort by them to make things uncomfortable. They had a team full of legends who, quite a few of them, finished in that series, and they were out to make a statement, and they'd had a lot of time to prepare for it as a team, how they're going to do it. If you flip that over to us, we were a team that was massively up and down, not quite sure. We had a change of leadership, and so we were a bit in turmoil.
Geraint Jones had made his international test debut just a few years earlier, aged 27. It was his catch of Michael Kasprowitz that had earned England a dramatic 2-run victory at Edgbaston in the 2005 Ashes. But throughout 2006, his place as wicketkeeper had been under review. Mike Hussey was also a late bloomer. By the time he reached his late 20s, he began to think his chance at international cricket was over.
I was honoured to really be in the same dressing room as some of those players, some of the greatest players that have played for Australia, like McGrath and Warne and Ponting and Gilchrist and Hayden and Langer. And, it was just a fantastic team, to be part of. So I think my overriding emotion was excitement. Obviously, there was plenty of nerves and anxiety there as well because it's obviously a massive series. But yeah, I was just really excited. One, just to have an opportunity to play, and two, just to be in the same dressing room as all those guys.
My teammates were incredible with their support for me, and also the management side. I think Duncan Fletcher really backed me up with the rest of the coaching staff. So I just felt all the pressure coming from the media box, to be honest, and from behind the microphones in the TV. And that affected me more than anything, probably. I went out there as number two, but quite early on in the tour, Duncan had said to me, "You'll be playing the first test match," and made that public. So that threw a lot of pressure on me to perform going into that first test.
At the expense of Andrew Strauss, Andrew Flintoff led the England team out for his first Ashes series as captain.
I understood Freddie being captain. Yeah, but then a part of me was thinking, well, just let him be Freddie, because I'd see him in the dressing room. I'd see him... the effort that he put into his performance. And I felt he was such a leader anyway with what he did, the way he was, that a big part of me said, well, can we just leave Freddie to do that? The extra pressure and the burden of captaining, how will that affect him?
Australia had already declared themselves favourites. The Gabba was packed with home fans anticipating the first cut of English blood. Australia won the toss.
Well, the first test is always a nervous time. It's everyone's on edge, and probably no no one more than Steve Harmison when he bowled the first ball to second slip, which probably just broke the ice for us a little bit. There was a huge roar in our viewing area. We couldn't believe what we'd seen. So it just sort of showed that everyone's nervous, and it just probably helped us relax a little bit as well. I was very nervous and just wanted to get my first run on the board. And I do remember Andrew Flintoff was in the middle of a pretty good spell and he was steaming in, and I thought, right, I'm going to have to be right on my game right from the first ball here. Thankfully, I had Ricky Ponting at the other end. He kept me calm and positive, and we were able to build a nice partnership.
Brisbane is where my family lives, so it gave me the opportunity to play in front of them. I'd been to the Gabba as a youngster and watched, and playing an Ashes test match in Australia is huge. It's what you dream of. So, yeah, of course, yeah, I was really proud. And because of that, probably put myself under far too much pressure to perform.
I felt like we were pretty comfortable throughout the test match, but England started to show some signs. Kevin Peterson got runs in the second innings, as did Paul Collingwood, and they played really well. So we were just thankful, I guess, to get over the line and get 1-0 up in the series, particularly at home. It was a great start for us. Well, we felt great to be 1-0 up, but we knew there was so much work to do. So normally speaking, we celebrate every single test match win with a lot of excitement, but the celebrations were good, but they were a little bit subdued. And I do remember Ricky sort of saying, okay, yeah, it's only one test win, so let's enjoy this one, but make sure tomorrow we wake up and we start preparing for the Adelaide test, because this is a very good England team and we're going to have to make sure that we're ready to go for number two.
Ashes to Ashes.
Australia had won comfortably in Brisbane by 277 runs. Days later, it was time for England to try and make amends.
Well, the Adelaide test is probably my favourite, really, on the Australian schedule. Everything about Adelaide is fantastic around that time of year. The whole city seems to come out for the test match. All the news is around test cricket. They've got the marquees set up at the back of the ground. The training facilities are unbelievable. The ground is just incredible as well. The outfield's like a bowling green. It's a very good batting pitch as well. So you're always excited to get to Adelaide and get into the preparation, the lead up. The hype was huge. It's a great city and they really love their test cricket. So you could really feel the atmosphere in the 3 or 4 days leading up to the test.
When you watch two players bat the way that Collie and KP did, you know, Collie ended up with a fantastic double 100 and KP 150. So brilliant batting. It's test match batting. It's what a way to answer after that first test match. I was thinking, right, this is showing some character from us as a group. Yes, two individuals are doing it out there in the middle. But as a group, we're answering back, you know, memories back to 2005, that we were standing up for ourselves after a not very good first test match. And so there are definite positive feelings. When you get 550 and you watch two guys bat and you keep the Aussie side out there. And cricket, whenever you manage to keep a side in the field for a day and a half, you know that it should be tough for their batters, you know, especially those first few.
I thought England were not just ahead, they were probably well ahead at that stage. Yeah, we hadn't got many wickets. They'd set a very, very good platform. It was a magnificent batting pitch, so we thought, we've got a lot of work to do here. Shane Warne wasn't that influential on the first day. They were batting beautifully. Kevin Peterson's a fantastic player, and we knew that coming in, and we knew we had to stop him in the series, and we couldn't on that particular day, or those two particular days. He was outstanding. And then Paul Collingwood, we know he's such a fighter. And then once he got into his groove as well, the runs were pretty hard to stop, and we found it hard. The bowlers, the pitch was really flat. The bowlers were toiling away. There was a lot of exhausted boys out there when England did finally declare. So it was a great partnership by them and certainly put England in the box seat.
You aim to get at least 400 on the board when you're batting first, and that puts a load of pressure on. So to get 550, we felt we were above that. We're on top of it. So declaring at 550 and having a chance to bowl them out, yeah, really positive move.
And Andrew Flintoff decides enough is enough. So the declaration has come. I think it's a well-timed declaration by England. Everything has gone to plan. They got the 550, which would have been their aim at tea time, and they've given themselves time to have a little dart at Australia this evening. Well played, England.
Paul Collingwood and Kevin Peterson's fourth wicket stand of 310 was a record for England against Australia. Justin Langer and Matthew Hayden opened in reply.
Watching a wicket and then getting out there and bowling on it, it was pretty obvious that it was a dead wicket, and so the Aussie bats, they could get in and score. I remember I spent a lot of time standing up to the stumps to Matthew Hoggard. You know, that was a strange, because the wicket just wasn't carrying through, and so there wasn't any real threat behind the stumps. So to create some pressure. I had to be up to the stumps, and you know, having spent so many test matches standing behind and watching Hoggy, you know, swing and seam it around, to be have to stand up to him just to create pressure, you know, it definitely rang through to me that it's going to be hard work, this test, and you know, we're going to have to really earn any result that we get out of it.
Well, I was very nervous because we'd lost a couple of early wickets. I think we were 3 down pretty cheaply, and England were, yeah, right on top. We had a bit of probably mental and physical fatigue from being in the field for the best part of 2 days, and it was desperate for Ricky and I to get a partnership together because we had to try and get up as close to that English score as we could. And it's always hard when you're trying to chase down such a big total because there is scoreboard pressure on you. You know, even if you feel like you're going well, you just know that if you lose one, you can lose another one quickly and you're well behind in the game. So every run was really tense. I think we were very lucky. Ricky was probably on top of his game at that stage, and that certainly helped me a lot as well. The English were putting so much time and effort and energy into trying to get Ricky out that took a bit of pressure off me and maybe some of their focus off me. So it enabled me just to get into my innings and build the partnership with Ricky.
Australia weren't just looking to rattle England with the bat. Shane Warne was looking for a verbal advantage too.
I remember him and Collie having a big battle in Adelaide. You know, them having a real ding-dong. I remember being up to the stumps and Collie was at first slip, Warne batting, and those two just going at it. Me in the middle sort of just listening to it. And that was because, you know, Collie scored a double 100, so he'd stood up to them, and that's something. So I just, if I've got it right, I think Warne was the guy in the Australian side tasked with putting the most pressure on us because they knew that he could do it with the ball at some point. And he was a character that liked a battle. That was always evident of playing against him, that when you walked out to the middle, you knew he was sizing you up, that he would find any chink in the armour he could.
Not just Collingwood. He'd have a crack at most of the guys out there. I think in the 2005 series, Collingwood might have come in for one of the last test matches. I'm not exactly sure. And when the England players got their, I think they were MBEs or something along those lines, Warney wasn't too happy about Collingwood getting one because he'd only sort of swanned in for the last test match. And so I think he reminded him of that fact quite a few times. But Ian Bell certainly copped a fair bit as well. I think Shane Warne thought he looked like the Shermanator from American Pie. And so that was quite humorous as well.
If Ricky Ponting was the star of Australia's innings with 142, it was his partnership with Hussey that provided the backbone, setting the home side up for a total to match England's.
I do remember getting out in the 90s, a second new baller from Hoggard, and I was just so disappointed to get out. I'd done all the hard work, batted all, you know, a long part of the day, and to get out, you know, it was a pretty meek dismissal, really. To get out like that later on the day when we were still, you know, a long way behind as well, was so disappointing. And I got quite angry with myself. And I was throwing gloves and pads and things around the dressing room, which wasn't really like me. I was generally quite calm, but I was just so disappointed that I'd worked my backside off all day and you know, got out just before getting 100. And also because we still needed plenty more runs. And yeah, Ricky actually, he did come in and say, right, pull your head in, mate. You're carrying on a bit too much, and some of the crowd can hear you as well.
Australia finished on 513 all out. There was a century for Michael Clarke, while Matthew Hoggard's 7 for 109 showed England were determined to keep the home side in check. But with a lot of runs on the board, time was running out.
The wicket actually played into their hand. Brett Lee, a terrific exponent of reverse swing and a wicket that wasn't really bouncing that much, scuffing up, so the ball reverse swung fairly early. And then you had Clarke and Glenn McGrath, who are miserly bowlers at best, and that was our biggest issue. We just didn't score runs. So we batted for a long enough time in that second innings, you know, 70-odd overs. But when you bat for 70 overs and you only score 130, I think it was, something like that, we were going nowhere, and that's the pressure that we felt.
I personally thought, well, it's looking like it's going to be a draw. It's going to be hard to force a result here. And I'm sure other players in the team were thinking exactly the same, but we never actually spoke about it until we got to the game on the start of day 5. And I vividly remember coming to the ground really relaxed and calm and thinking, you know, the press were talking, saying it's going to be a draw. Everyone I spoke to in the public said it's going to be a draw. I thought it was going to be a draw. We sat it down in the dressing room and Ricky, Shane Warne and John Buchanan called a team meeting. And this was really unusual during a test match to call a team meeting. And Ricky sat everyone down and said, right, you guys, we can bloody win this test match. but we need to figure out and work out as a team how we're going to win this test match. We can go one of two ways. We can really look to attack. Bowlers just go for wickets every ball. We'll set attacking fields. They might get a few extra runs, but we've got to take these last nine English wickets and then go and chase down the runs. Or we can go the other way and we can just say, be a little bit defensive with our field settings, just bowl dot ball after dot ball and hopefully the pressure will build up. We might get a lucky dismissal here or there. And I remember sitting in the back room thinking, is he serious? Does he really think we can win? And he remember him saying to us, look, we can win this test match, but everyone in this room needs to believe that we can win this test match.
You know, the Australian bowlers bowled straight, bowled really well to the wicket and strangled us. And we felt that pressure and didn't score anywhere near what we needed to. And that was our biggest downfall. That we probably should have kept positive and looked to be in a position to bowl them out rather than just hang in there for a draw. One thing that happened as well on that tour was that, I'm sure it was by design, but the Australian cricket had deliberately, we felt, disperse the Barmy Army because they knew how much of an advantage they were for even other side of the world. It was thousands and thousands there, so they had put them all in different sections. And I think Billy the trumpeter wasn't allowed his trumpet. It was a real national effort against us, and you know, that included being in the crowd. And so, where the Barmy Army usually get together and are such a force, you know, as a player in the middle, you can switch some attention to the Barmy Army and see what they're up to, so it helps you get away from that tension of the test match. But I do remember that series, that the Barmy Army just being spread everywhere, so it really dissipated their support. They were able to, and that was pretty evident on that last day.
Ashes to Ashes, Adelaide 2006, with Mike Hussey and Geraint Jones.
England fell apart, losing their final nine wickets for just 60 runs. Australia had bowled them out for 129, and Shane Warne was magnificent, with figures of 4 for 49. They needed 168 runs in quick time to pull off an incredible win.
Well, we made a slight change in the batting order, and Ricky wanted a left-hander to come in at number 4, so I went to number 4 and Damien Martin went to 5, and that was to try and manipulate Ashley Giles a bit more because he was going to be bowling into the rough and defensively for the right-hander, so they needed a left-hander in there just to sort of mix it up. So, again, I was lucky to have Ricky at the other end, who was in great touch. And it was more like a one-day innings, really, and a one-day chase, and that's the way we wanted to approach it. Let's just be busy. Let's get a partnership going. Let's just try and take it as deep as we possibly can, and we'll see where we're at. And that's the way we played. We just tried to, manipulate the ball, manipulate the field, run hard between the wickets. The crowd was huge as well. You know, you could almost see them just fleeing down from the city just to sort of catch the last hour or so of the action. They were counting down every single run, yelling it out. It was an incredible atmosphere out there in the middle.
As each over went by, and it was pretty obvious that the test match was turning, and the Aussie crowd, they're pretty quiet when it's not going their way, but as soon as they've got a sniff of victory, they come alive. So if you're on the boundary, you're going to know about that. And so that was evident, that the crowd was becoming louder and the support for the Aussies was getting, and they were drowning out what the Barmy Army were doing, so that added to it all, knowing that this test match is turning. Everyone can tell that.
Hussey saw his team home, scoring 61 not out and hitting the winning runs with three overs to spare.
It would be fitting if Mike Hussey hits the winning stroke. There it is, arms aloft. What a win for Australia. A stunning test match victory here in Adelaide. They look down and out at the end of day two, England declaring, putting the pressure on, Australia losing an early wicket. It was all going England's way, but Australia have played stunning test match cricket over the last 3 days. It's been a memorable victory, one of their very best. And they lead this series now 2-0.
Well, without doubt, it's the best feeling I've ever had on a cricket field, you know, even to this day. I probably let the emotions get to me a little bit too much as we got closer and closer. And I remember with about 5 or 6 runs to get, I had this huge hit of nerves and thinking, I really desperately want to be out here for the end, to be here at the end. And I was probably carrying on a bit too much, and I must have been really annoying the England players. I was doing fist pumps, and I just couldn't control my emotions. But when I finally hit those winning runs, just the raw emotion just poured out of me. Seeing the faces of the people in the crowd was just amazing. And then the faces of my teammates as well.
just deflation. How's that happened? That roller coaster of emotions from the morning, thinking, right, okay, the series is alive still, to one where you're sitting in your chair at the end of the day and you just know that that's the series done. You can't come back from 2-0 down. That wasn't going to happen. And so for me, having been involved in a series where we'd lost the first one in 2005 and then won it and created, and knowing how important that was, that the second test match, how crucial that is in a 5-test match series to be able to, if we'd have been able to hang on and draw that going into Perth, would have been a massive boost for us. But the fact that we couldn't, and the circumstances around it pretty much blew everyone away, and that was the series gone. And so I think that was a real killer blow, and from there it was pretty obvious that the next 3 test matches would be really, really tough.
Seeing the players run onto the field to congratulate us, and it was bizarre because we don't really do that sort of thing in Australia. And afterwards, listening to guys like Ricky and Shane Warne, who had played well over 100 test matches, for them to say that's, the best test match they've ever been involved in, it just made it so special. And you felt for England because they'd played really well throughout the test. But I kept coming back in my mind thinking to that team meeting that Ricky called on day 5 and just sowed the seed of belief that we could win and that we should always go for the win. And I think that was really important in the wash-up.
It was a time for Mike Hussey to show what he was about, because he'd spent a lot of time playing first-class cricket and building up an incredible reputation as a player. And so to come into that Ashes series at home, it was his chance to show how good he was. And he did that. And he in that chasing down those runs, he led the way. He's known as Mr. Cricket, and you could tell that from the moment he came out there, he was all about winning the Test match. And in stark contrast to the way we batted, his energy was the biggest thing. When he came out to the wicket, he was dropping and running, quick singles, everything that we should have been doing. He was almost saying to us, "This is how it's done. I'm winning this Test match, and this is how you should have batted."
We stayed in the dressing rooms for quite a few hours after that game, and some of the English players came in and had a bit of a chat, and obviously they were pretty disappointed, but they lightened up pretty quickly. I think Andrew Flintoff wanted to stay for our team song, which was quite amusing at the time. Justin Langer had great delight in kicking him out when we wanted to sing the team song, so that was quite amusing as well. But spirits were obviously high. We still knew we had to win another Test match at least. But we had a little bit of, turmoil as well, because Damien Martin didn't turn up at the airport the next day and as we were flying off to Perth. And I thought he must have just had a big night and missed his alarm the next morning. But, rumours were surfacing that he'd actually retired and he'd sort of just disappeared. He didn't tell anyone in the team. And that turned out to be true. He sort of snuck off to Sydney, went underground for a while, and it was a bit bizarre, really, because no one was expecting it. So, we had to sort of deal with that in our own minds, I guess, as well, and then try and switch on for Perth.
Australia's dominance was unassailable. Victory at the third test in Perth earned them back the Ashes. The eventual 5-0 whitewash England suffered proved only to deepen the wound. It hit Flintoff and the England team hard.
It sort of emerged that Andrew Flintoff was probably not at 100% fitness throughout the tournament as well, with, suffering from a bit of a knee problem. So he probably wasn't quite at his best. And our team was just so determined. I just remember how intense and how much these guys wanted it coming into the series. And so probably with England losing some key players and maybe a couple of key players not being 100% fit, and then Australia being 100% switched on and wanting to, desperately regain those Ashes, playing in our home conditions, once we got a bit of confidence and momentum going, it was just always going to be really hard for England. But no, we still had enormous respect for that England team. We always thought it was going to be a tough battle. And look, even those Test matches, even though we won 5-0, it was still good, hard, tough Ashes cricket, but we were just able to do it for longer.
Freddie was down. You could tell that. Freddie and I got on really well, and I could see he was hurting because it was such a great honour for him to be named captain. And then to see wheels falling off, 5-0 loss written, you know, so he was devastated. He really was. And it was because playing cricket for England was such a, filled him with such pride. And that's why he was the player he was. He gave everything on the pitch. So he left nothing out there. The amount of times I would see him literally collapse in his chair after a day's play, just from efforts that he'd given. And that, yeah, it was sad. I felt, yeah, I probably let him down in terms of performance, because knowing how much it meant to him, being given the captaincy and wanting to do well, the pride and the honour he had with doing that. So as a good friend of his, and not being able to support him with my efforts on the field, it was hard to watch.
Geraint Jones didn't play for England again. The series also marked the retirement of several Australia legends.
Well, I do remember sitting in the SCG dressing rooms after that series, and I was actually sitting with Ricky. And we were just having a chat and thinking, you know, reflecting on how great a series it had been for Australia, and how, I guess, chuffed we were with our performances as a team and individually. And but then you can't really afford to reflect for too long, because, you know, we had McGrath, Warne and Langer all retiring. And I remember turning to Ricky and saying, it's going to get a lot harder now, isn't it? You know, and he said, yep, it sure is, but let's not worry about that now. We've got to enjoy the moment now and enjoy tonight.
With thanks to Paul Hayward and Sheil Berry, Ashes to Ashes is produced by Kate Borsay. As soon as they're released, the other episodes in this five-part series will be available on iTunes, where you can leave us a review or go to telegraph.co.uk. Ashes to Ashes is a production by The Telegraph.